The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
How can we understand the trauma of the Israel-Palestine conflict in the context of biblical prophecy? I'll talk about that. And CNN's Don Lemon says the January 6th walkthrough was, in fact, a war. Spoken like a guy who's never been to war. This is the Dinesh D'Souza podcast.
Needs this voice. The times are crazy. In a time of confusion, division, and lies, we need a brave voice of reason, understanding, and truth. This is the Dinesh D'Souza Podcast.
We're seeing almost day by day a tremendous and horrific escalation of the Israel-Palestine conflict. More rockets fired from the Hamas side at Israeli civilians. Israel stepping up its response. I see that Netanyahu has basically said, I'm going to make these people pay a heavy price. And Israel also talking about the fact that this could be a protracted, a long-lasting conflict. Very traumatizing for them and very sad for us to watch across the across the ocean. Why? Because we identify with these people, identify with what they're going through. This little country sitting in the middle of surrounded by enemies, enemies, by the way, not just in the Muslim world, but enemies all over the world, almost isolated, having typically to rely on only a single ally, the United States. And now even that is somewhat in question. All of this is hard to watch. And there is a key moral distinction. The Hamas people are attacking Israeli civilians deliberately. And they're also, in a sense, setting up their camps in areas that have civilian populations. Why? Because then when Israel fires back, they can say, oh, you killed civilians. Even though the killing of civilians on both sides is being driven, you may say, by Hamas. Now, from America's point of view, and some Americans will look at all this, and I see this is true of the secular media. It's also true of the secular Jews in America. A lot of them don't seem to really care about Israel. At least that is the significance one can attach to their actions, to their political indifference to what is happening. But that is not the case in Israel. In Israel, there is a powerful sense, and this is shared by religious Jews, but it's also shared by secular Jews, that there is a sort of providential, one may almost say miraculous significance to Israel. And that's what I want to talk about. I want to begin by talking about this conflict at the wide angle view. In the next segment, I'm going to zoom in and talk specifically at the kind of narrow, the more close up view, you might say. But here I want to talk about the millennial, the messianic, the biblical significance of Israel. I was talking to a Jewish commentator some years ago now from Israel, and he was talking about Zionism. And he made the point, he said, I'm a secular Jew. He says, you know, Jews traditionally are the people who rejected Jesus as the Messiah. Why? Because they believed that some other later Messiah was going to be the true Messiah. And he said, and the religious Jews are still hopeful. They're still waiting for this Messiah, this true Messiah to show up. He said, well, we're not. We secular Jews don't think there's going to be another kind of genuine, the real article Messiah. He says, but we attach that same religious significance to the state of Israel. In other words, our Zionism, our belief in the idea of the Jews coming back together to their ancestral land, we invest that with a certain kind of sacred significance. So Zionism, he was saying, remarkably, is the fulfillment of a kind of messianic hope. The return of the Jewish people to Israel is perhaps the most significant prophecy in the Bible pointing to the beginning of the end times. I emphasize the beginning of the end times because the end times could be a day, a year, perhaps even a century. I'm not trying to sort of put a date on it. I'm not trying to say we are in the last year or the last even decades of the end of the world. But I am saying that the last age, when the Bible talks about, uses words like age, and notice that in the first book of Genesis, it talks also about the days of creation, which some people have interpreted as ages in the first age and the second age and so on. So are we in the final epoch? Well, Christians believe, and I think rightly, based upon biblical prophecy, that Israel's side is God's side. So that to take sides against Israel is by and large to take sides with the enemy of God. And this is the way in which the Old Testament, you may say, is incorporated into the New. Even though Christ brings forward a new dispensation, Christ is, you may say, a new Moses, the early apostles decide that you don't have to follow the Jewish laws if you are a Christian. But nevertheless, there is this deep spiritual link with the Jews. And I think that Christians in America believe, and I believe, that Israel is a providential nation. Just as, by the way, I believe that America is a providential nation. So you have a kind of spiritual linking of two providential nations. And what do we mean by providential nations? It's important to understand we don't actually mean that God only cares about Israel or God only cares about America. In fact, it's very clear in the Old Testament that when God chose the Jews, they are the chosen people. But chosen for what? Are they chosen for their moral excellence? Are they chosen for their deep devotion to God? No. They're chosen, you may say, by just divine decree. Many times the Jews in the Old Testament are not faithful to God. They turn away from him, and this stimulates, you know, God's jealousy, God's wrath. Why? Because these people that he chose, just because he chose them. And the chosenness here implies not only a certain kind of privilege, but also a certain kind of responsibility. The Jews, as God's chosen people, have special duties, special allegiances to God that's not expected of the so-called Gentiles at the time. Now, very interestingly, when I speak what seems to be sort of religious language, and some secular people are, what is Dinesh even talking about? Isn't this supposed to be a secular podcast? But the truth of the matter is, the Muslims understand this language. When you talk about a providential nation, when you talk about God's will in the world, the Muslims understand this. When they use terms like infidel, they're speaking about the enemies of God. They're using themselves a kind of theological language. I think of Biden's role in this crazy situation. I just saw there's a lot of left-wing angst over Biden's decision to actually provide, at this moment, additional military aid to Israel, $735 million in additional, not humanitarian, not food aid, not even economic aid, but military aid. And the left is like, oh my gosh, what's going on here? I almost feel like Biden here is a kind of Pontius Pilate. He's the guy caught in the middle of the situation. He would rather not have to deal with it. Here he has on one side these Pharisees, and oddly enough, the Pharisees here are people like Ilhan Omar, AOC. They're screaming for vengeance. Oh, turn against Israel, crucify Israel. And Biden's like, they haven't really done anything wrong. They're the ones who have been attacked in this situation. So Biden would love to wash his hands off the matter, but he is being pushed. He is being pressured by his own side and by his own party to yield, to give in, to switch America's traditional allegiance toward Israel. I'm not sure where all this is going to go. Israel clearly is the stronger party here, and I'm happy to see that they don't seem to lack the will. And how can they? I mean, this is an existential fight for them. If they only have to lose once, they have to win every single time just to stay in existence as a country. I don't know if Biden has the will to support Israel, but I'm certainly hoping, and I would add praying, that Israel has the will to defend itself. This weekend saw a sharp escalation of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, with Israel bombing the house of a Hamas Gaza leader, the Hamas itself escalating from its end, firing 120 rockets between the middle of Saturday and the middle of Sunday. There have now been close to 200 Palestinian casualties, also casualties, civilian casualties on the Israeli side. I thought I would try to zoom in, go close up into this fight by looking at an incident that's caused a lot of outrage, particularly in the media, and that is Israel's bombing of the 12-story AP Tower in the Gaza area. Now, this tower housed AP and Al Jazeera and some other news agencies. And Israel says it also housed Hamas intelligence. Hamas intelligence had secreted itself in this building. So at first, when I saw the bombing of the AP building, AP was making it sound like their building was targeted because they're media. I want to actually quote AP. They go, "We are shocked and horrified that the Israeli military would target and destroy the building housing AP's bureau and other news organizations in Gaza." And then this is the AP president and CEO Gary Pruitt, and this is the stuff part that makes me chuckle. The whole thing doesn't make me chuckle, but this does. "The world will know less about what's happening in Gaza. The world, as if the whole world is relying on AP to give it the news." Now, interestingly, I've been following AP coverage, and Debbie has too, and we both noticed that the AP coverage of the Israel-Palestinian conflict is completely from the Palestinian point of view. In other words, AP is indistinguishable from Al Jazeera. AP is like America's answer to Al Jazeera. And interestingly, AP and Al Jazeera were both in that building. So the first question is that why Israel targeted the building? But Israel goes, no, we targeted the building because it's a legitimate target. This is Benjamin Netanyahu speaking to the Jerusalem Post. He goes, "The intelligence we had is about an intelligence office for Hamas housed in that building that plots and organizes terrorist attacks on Israeli civilians. It's a legitimate target." Evidently, Israel has communicated this to the American government. They've shown, quote, the smoking gun of where Hamas is located and what they were doing. Now, I see that here in AP itself, they quote Secretary of State Antony Blinken. "Blinken hasn't seen any evidence on AP Gaza building strike." Now, first of all, I love this. "Hasn't seen any evidence." This is the good old, something doesn't happen because I haven't seen it. I haven't seen any evidence of election fraud. Ergo, there's no election fraud. I mean, I could continue like this all day. I haven't seen any evidence for the existence of Australia. Does that mean Australia doesn't exist because I've never been there? I haven't seen any evidence. I love this mode of reasoning on the part of AP. But nevertheless, here's the point. Hamas invites these attacks on civilians. They install their offices in places where there are civilians. Why? Because they want there to be civilian casualties. And then they go, "Oh, look at all these innocent dead people. Just look at the villainous behavior of Israel." Even though Hamas is obviously complicit in these deaths. Why? Because they are sort of setting it up. They're setting it up to create civilian casualties. Now, in that sense, Hamas are accessories. Now, I don't think that AP is really an innocent party here either. Why? Because AP typically goes to Hamas. And maybe this is why it's useful for AP to be in the same building. They mainly use Hamas sources. Hamas goes, "Oh, yeah, there's a five-year-old who's wounded over there. Let's take you right there." AP's like, "Oh, yeah, we're ready. We're going to get the cameras. You know, Frank, let's go." So what's going on here is a collusion between AP and Hamas. There was an interesting article in The Atlantic just a few years ago now where they talked about the fact that any reporter for organizations like AP that doesn't cover this from the Hamas point of view gets threatened by Hamas. And so what they do is they kind of make their news conform to Hamas, but they don't report anything about the threats under which they're living. So the conditions of them to be able to report from inside the Palestinian quarter is that they have to tell the story from the Palestinian point of view. In other words, what we're dealing here is fake news in the classic sense. When this fellow, you know, This AP guy, Gary Pruitt, says, "The world won't know." What he really means is the world won't get its share of Palestinian propaganda courtesy of AP. So the bottom line of it here is that the bombing of the building, obviously tragic, but let's remember that the Israeli government warned the reporters beforehand. That's how there were actually no journalistic casualties. They got out. And again, AP is sort of lying about this because one of these AP guys goes, you know, I was very lucky to get out, implying that Israel really bears the responsibility. I just survived by the skin of my teeth. And here's Netanyahu responding to that. He goes, wait a minute. He goes, one of the AP journalists said we were lucky to get out. And Netanyahu goes, no, you weren't lucky to get out. It wasn't luck. We took special trouble to tell you about what was happening. So here's the AP guy acting as if the bomb came flying. He spotted it at the last minute. He took off. He was lucky to get out, whereas in fact he had been notified in advance. He got out of the building. Then it was struck. So even in this little episode, you begin to see fake news in full display. And all of this is kind of like what the war looks like close up. Totally different from the kind of propaganda you get from the AP stories themselves. Mike Lindell, of course, is known for his classic pillows, but he's always coming up with ingenious new products. And the newest one, My Slippers. Mike has taken over 2 years to develop. They're designed to wear indoor and outdoor all day long. These MyPillow slippers are made with MyPillow foam and impact gel to help prevent fatigue. They're made with quality leather suede. And for a limited time, Mike is offering 40% off the new My Slippers. They're so comfortable, you'll want to get some for the whole family. Debbie and I just love ours. I got the moccasins. She got the slip-ons. Go to MyPillow.com and use promo code Dinesh. Deep discounts on all the MyPillow products, the Giza Dream Bed Sheets, the MyPillow Mattress Topper, and MyPillow Towel Sets. Call 800-876-0227 or go to MyPillow.com. Don't forget to use promo code Dinesh. The politics of COVID, and particularly the origins of COVID, continues to unravel. Now, Rand Paul has been berating the media for its failure to confront Fauci on this. Rand Paul himself tried to corner Fauci, and he basically said, hey, listen, isn't it true that America has provided funding to the Wuhan lab, and there's now reasonably good reasons to believe that the Wuhan lab may well have been the origins of the virus. They made it. It was part of their souping up process. It was part of their gain-of-function research, so-called, in which they take deadly viruses and make them deadlier, supposedly to study them, to try to come up with better ways to understand them. But nevertheless, they're doing this. Wuhan lab is indisputably doing this. And Fauci's like, no, we don't provide funding to the Wuhan lab. And then Rand Paul says, wait a minute, you may not provide funding directly to the Wuhan lab, but you provide funding to a lot of labs in America that share research with the Wuhan lab on precisely this kind of souping up or making the virus deadlier or gain of function research. This is, I'm now quoting Rand Paul. He goes, Fauci knows that his group gave money, but he's saying, oh, it was for other research. It was for something else. And then Rand Paul says, it's sort of like the Planned Parenthood argument. Yes, we give taxpayer money to Planned Parenthood, but it's not for abortion. And so the point that Rand Paul is making is that Planned Parenthood takes the money, uses it for something else, and that's how they've got more of their own money to use for abortion. Similarly, the same thing can be said about the Wuhan lab. We fund them and support them in other ways, and this allows them to devote more of their own resources to this gain-of-function research. Now, very interestingly, there is a new letter from a group of 18 world-class scientists basically saying, enough of this propaganda which assumes that the virus came out of a market. No. I'm going to quote them now. This is a letter in the journal Science. And the organizer of the letter, Jesse Bloom, a virologist at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center in Seattle, and David Relman, this is a world-famous microbiologist at Stanford University. These people have never spoken out before on COVID. And I'm quoting now one of them, Bloom. He goes, anybody who's making statements with a high level of certainty about this is just outstripping what it's possible to do with available evidence. So they're not saying it came out of the lab. What they're saying is that the pompous proclamations that came out of many sources, including this guy, Christian Anderson, a virologist at Scripps, who basically said, this came out of a meat market. It's a conspiracy theory. It came out of a lab. That's been debunked. And of course, the media ran with this debunked theory. Not only did the media run with the debunked theory, but digital media jumped into the act. Lots of people got their accounts suspended, got their posts taken down. Why? Because they implied that it might have been possible for the virus to come out of the lab. A perfectly reasonable position to take. And this really shows you the Orwellian role of these so-called fact checkers. The fact checkers rely on a doctor, in this case, Christian Anderson, go, Dr. Anderson says it's debunked. Dr. Anderson says it's a conspiracy theory. When Dr. Anderson is speaking only for himself, and very often the virologists who were saying these things were directly involved in the gain-of-function research themselves. In other words, they wanted to move the blame away from themselves. Oh, it came out of a market. We're not part of this. We're not responsible for unleashing this deadly virus on the world. But now these leading scientists are saying, listen, we need a thorough investigation because the so-called investigation done by the WHO was thwarted by China, and the Chinese government has been keeping information very close to its chest. So the new letter doesn't come down in favor of one scenario or another. Here's Michael Worobia, an evolutionary biologist at the University of Arizona. He says he signed the new letter because, quote, the recent WHO report on the origins of the virus and its discussion spurred several of us to get in touch with each other and talk about our shared desire for dispassionate investigation of the origins of the virus. Here is Sarah Kobe, an epidemiologist and evolutionary biologist at the University of Chicago. Quote, I'm concerned about the short and long-term consequences of failing to evaluate the possibility of laboratory escape in a rigorous way. It would be a troublesome precedent. Dr. Relman, this is a Stanford microbiologist, says that the piece that Christian Anderson and four others wrote last March, in my view, simply fails to provide evidence to support their conclusion. So what you have here is leading figures, leading virologists, leading figures in the medical community, basically saying that from the beginning of COVID until now, this doctrine that it didn't come out of the Wuhan lab, which was the basis not only of media propaganda, but digital censorship, is not a proven doctrine. It's not even close to being a proven doctrine. In fact, if you believe Nicholas Wade's rigorous examination of the evidence, he says, look, if you look at the actual clues available, of which there are many, they all point in the same direction. They all point to the Wuhan lab. So this stuff is being blown wide open. And the little ogre Fauci might find himself, this is a little bit why he's ducking and weaving, and the media is kind of letting him get away with it because they're not pinning him down. Oh, you didn't directly fund the Wuhan lab. Oh, that's excellent. Thank you for the clarification, Dr. Fauci, as opposed to, yes, but did you fund other groups that provided both research support and funding to Wuhan indirectly? So you were, in fact, a hand feeding the Wuhan lab, even though you deny an explicit connection. I'm going to stay on top of the story because I think that this is a huge story of where the virus came from. Think of this, a virus that's killed millions of people worldwide, that's produced a huge death toll in the United States, that's touched almost every family, certainly in the country, if not on the planet. And if our people and our country and our medical establishment had something to do with it, I'm not that surprised the Chinese did. But if we are in on it, I think the American people deserve to know. You know the food I learned to love during the COVID lockdown? Omaha Steaks. Debbie likes her cooking simple and easy. These Omaha Steaks are delicious, and I say this as a foodie who is not so easily convinced. I have so many favorites. Their beef stroganoff, the fully cooked pot roast, the chicken and dumplings, the jambalaya, and of course the filet mignon. Summer's almost here, and that means backyard grill outs. And this is not complete without Omaha Steaks. Visit omahasteaks.com and enter keyword Dinesh in the search bar to order the mouth-watering Let's Go Grill package today. Not only do you get the whole package with great savings, you get a tasty bonus, 12 ultra-juicy Omaha Steak burgers free. That's almost 4 pounds of free burgers. To top it off, you also get $20 off on your first order. The Let's Go Grill package includes 4 butcher-cut filet mignons, 4 boneless pork chops, 1 pound of chicken breasts, 4 kielbasa sausages, and more. Debbie and I love warm weather. We can't wait to get the grill ready for some great burgers, steaks, and more. Omaha Steaks guarantees you'll have the best steak of your life. Go to omahasteaks.com and use the code Dinesh in the search bar. For a limited time, you'll get 12 free Omaha Steak burgers and 20% off at checkout on your first order. That's omahasteaks.com, keyword Dinesh. It's become increasingly apparent to people watching my podcast, but in general, intelligent people following the debate, that the massively overheated rhetoric over January 6th, it's an insurrection, it's a terrorist attack, it's a coup. First of all, think about what a coup means. A coup is, in fact, a planned, organized effort, usually involving the military, although not necessarily, to overthrow the government and take over. Now, let's match that up with January 6th. Here you have a bunch of guys, sort of like campus protesters, who push their way in, they walk in the hallways, they take selfies with podiums, and they show off their feathers and their animal horns, and then a couple of hours later, they voluntarily leave. What kind of a coup is that? That's not what Pinochet did in Chile. It's not a coup. Everybody knows it's not a coup. And yet you have a continuing spate of absurdities coming out from the left. Here's Biden. It's the worst attack since the Civil War. Merrick Garland, the attorney general, compares it to the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing. Nonsense. And then Don Lemon, never to be outdone. We're talking about Don Lemon, winner of the Stupidity Award at CNN last year and the year before, narrowly edged out by Rachel Maddow the year before. But here's Don Lemon basically saying that it wasn't just a coup, it wasn't just an insurrection, it was actually a war. Listen.
I spoke with a Republican lawmaker last night, and he told me during the commercial break, he said, listen, I fought in the war, Denver Riggleman. He said, I went to war. And he said, but the difference was, is that I didn't have people denying the realities of war or denying my experience. And what happened at the Capitol was nothing less than war. As I said, hand-to-hand combat. And to have people deny that is just disgusting.
First of all, you can be fairly sure that this conversation with the Republican man who went to war never happened. This is ventriloquist journalism, Don Lemon style. But look, I mean, we all know what a war is. The Civil War, 600,000 casualties. World War II, the Vietnam War, huge numbers of people dead. Let's start with that. If this was a war, how many people were killed? Answer, one. A Trumpster, Ashley Babbitt, killed by a black Capitol Hill police officer. And that's it. They tried for a while to make it two, Brian Sicknick. But even two doesn't really seem to comport with the rhetoric of war. And so what you have here is not only rhetorical inflation, but rhetorical debasement. Now, the eerie part of this is the premise on which the Biden administration is prosecuting these January 6 protesters. And they keep making all these kinds of incendiary allegations about them. And here's my question. Where's the videotape? Because every part of what happens in the Capitol, inside and outside, is videotaped. And the simple fact of the matter is the government has the videotape. It's actually, it's 14,000 hours of videotape. But you know what? They refuse to show it. The only footage that we've seen, by and large, of what happened on January 6th comes from reporters. Some of it came, for example, from a New Yorker journalist. The House impeachment manager selectively used footage to try to make their points. Look at this guy yelling over there. Look at that guy pushing over here. But the whole videotape, where is it? The government has it. They claim, and this is how preposterous they are. They say, we can't provide the footage. Why? Quote, our concern is that providing unfettered access to hours of extremely sensitive information, to defendants who have already shown a desire to interfere with the democratic process will be passed on to those who might wish to attack the Capitol again. So they don't even want to provide the footage to defendants because the defendants can then say, look at the context. That's not what this means. You're showing people edited, doctored footage. They have the footage, they won't show it. Now, we now know kind of why they won't show it. The website American Greatness, and this is the work of the intrepid journalist Julie Kelly, has uncovered a small piece of videotape, which I'm about to show you. And this gives you a pretty good idea of why the U.S. government, the Biden administration, is suppressing the footage. Listen.
Here are willing to work with us and cooperate peacefully, like our First Amendment allows. Gather more Americans under the condition that they will come and gather peacefully to discuss what needs to be done to save our country.
One other or the other.
You need a show.
we're going to be heard. Everybody, this must be peaceful.
This has to be peaceful. We have the right to peacefully assemble.
Now, a couple of things are critical about this. First of all, that is the that's the Q shaman guy. That's the guy with the horns that you're seeing. That's Jacob Chansley. And what does he emphasize from beginning to the end? We have to be peaceful. He's very emphatic about this point. And then, very interestingly, he engages in a conversation with Officer Keith Robichaud, who says on the tape to Chansley, he goes, "We're not against," I'm quoting him now, "you need to show us no attacking, no assault, remain calm." Basically, the police officer is giving these guys permission to go in as long as, it's a conditional permission, as long as there's no attacking, no assault, remain calm, stay peaceful. So what you have here, very tellingly, is an engagement, and a peaceful engagement, not hand-to-hand combat in Don Lemon's fevered imagination, but rather a discussion in which the cop basically goes, okay, but make sure that you guys behave yourself. So think of how powerful this evidence is in dispelling all this nonsense about a coup, nonsense about an insurrection. These are people who are trying to make their voices heard. They're trying to conduct a demonstration, a peaceful demonstration. The cops know that. And the cops are, in a sense, collaborating with them in making sure it stays peaceful. It is this truth of January 6th that the left is desperately trying to suppress, the Biden administration is desperately trying to suppress in its wicked and irresponsible witch hunt against its political opponents. As the Biden administration goes berserk with all kinds of proposed and planned spending, student debt forgiveness, more stimulus checks, expanded unemployment benefits, a $2 trillion infrastructure plan, the obvious question is, what's the economic impact? Who's going to pay? Clearly, the Biden administration thinks they're playing with monopoly money. Listen, if all your investments are tied to greenbacks, you're sitting on a ticking time bomb. Invest a portion of your savings into gold and silver. Now, Birch Gold Group is the company I purchased from. This is the company you can trust to convert an IRA, eligible 401k, into an IRA backed by gold and silver. That's right. Through a little-known tax loophole, you can convert your retirement savings tied to the stock market into an IRA backed by precious metals. It's your hedge against inflation and government irresponsibility. Text Dinesh to 484848 for your free information kit on precious metals IRAs or to speak with a Birch Gold representative today. With 10,000 customers, an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau, countless five-star reviews, Birch Gold can help you too. Text Dinesh to 484848 and invest in gold and precious metals before it's too late. I'm really happy to welcome on the podcast Lionel, who is a social media personality. He's the founder and he's the head of Lionel Media, lionelmedia.com. I follow him on Twitter. This is a guy who likes to tell it like it is, and he tells it with a lot of verve and passion and insight. Lionel, thanks for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. Let me start by asking you, you've been talking a lot about COVID. And the CDC, of course, recently said, hey, listen, we're gonna let the mask requirement slide. It's no longer a requirement, not just for indoor, but also for outdoor. And the left is going a little berserk about this. It seems like it's rattled their worldview, which I guess had become... had accommodated to this idea that we're going to have some sort of a facial burqa going forward indefinitely. What do you make of the CDC rule, and where do you think we are in this COVID controversy?
Well, COVID, frankly, is a religion, and the vaccine is a sacrament, and the CDC is the Vatican. It's this weird, almost a cult-like exercise in learned helplessness. One of the things that they did, Dinesh, was to provide inconsistent messaging over and over again to the point where you don't know what to do. You throw into the mix Fauci, who was from another dimension, to even throw in more confusion. And frankly, what we've done in the past, what, year or year and a half, who knows, is a complete and befuddled citizenship. And I believe, or citizenry, and I believe it's done, believe it or not, by design.
Now, when you say by design, I mean, I guess one could say, listen, this was a dangerous virus. Not a lot was known about it. Maybe at the beginning, they didn't know that we needed masks and they decided that perhaps we do. So could one benignly interpret their behavior as a sort of adaptive response to new information? And If not, if this is just bad guys who want to sort of use this as a pretext for tyranny, who do you think are the, I mean, is Fauci the little ogre behind it all, or who's really pushing the agenda?
Well, you give me about nine great questions here. First of all, is this some kind of a benign response to something which is somehow difficult to understand through the calculus of virology? No. The idea of transmission has this is not exactly mind-boggling. This is not befuddling anybody. The idea of the mask, let me go back in time. You had Fauci, who, by the way, is the court jester of this whole thing. He came out and said, cruises are okay, quote, hooking up is okay, wet markets are okay, eating live bats. Okay, I threw that one in for laughs, but he threw in and basically said everything is fine, and then almost immediately said, whatever I just said, forget it. Now, you mean to tell me that somebody of his alleged renown does not know the basic mechanics of viral transmission? Do you think that COVID or CV-1984, as some might call it, is so different? By the way, remember, this is the only asymptomatic pandemic that basically shut down the world. So I don't want to get too, dare I say, conspiratorial. But as Gore Vidal says, I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I'm a conspiracy analyst.
I see. Well, do you think that, you know, I saw Rachel Maddow reacting to the CDC's guideline, and she made a sort of confession, I think, without quite intending to. She goes, well, in the past, when I saw people without a mask, I could kind of automatically hate them because they were obviously these right wing people who showed no sensitivity either to their own health or anybody else's. Now, if I see people without a mask, they could be liberals. They could be one of us from her point of view. So I don't know whether I can kind of automatically hate them anymore. It appears this woman is having a sort of emotional breakdown because her hatred channel has now become, you know, befuddled.
Well, you know what's interesting? Dinesh, do you know anybody who, after having braces that were applied, kept them on? Anybody who demanded to keep their sutures in? Anybody who said, keep the cast on my leg after my bones have healed? I always thought that the mask was a barrier method, and that was simply it. But again, it's taken on almost like a vestment. It's taken on some type of a sign, of a code, of some type of, you know, the semiotics or the escutcheon of either the woke or anti-Trump. I don't know. But believe me when I tell you this, one day social scientists and behaviorists are going to dissect and parse what happened. Because believe it or not, this has nothing to do with the virus. Let me repeat. The only basically asymptomatic pandemic that shut down the world. And I'm not an anti-vaxxer. Very quickly, Merriam-Webster just added that anti-vaxxer is now somebody who does not believe in vaccines, but also does not believe in mandatory vaccines. So even that definition has expanded. So that's the transmutations of this are fascinating.
Let's turn to the broader issue of the Biden administration, because it seems that, you know, it seems that in a very short time, just a few months, we're seeing fairly dramatic movements in a tyrannical direction, and even things that seemed off the table. I mean, I was talking to a friend of mine from Canada, and he goes, I know that you Americans were fighting over the Second Amendment. I didn't think you were fighting over the First. And he meant that he didn't think that free speech itself would become some kind of a threatened commodity. But it has in the Biden era. And this is not just private companies, congressional Democrats. The Biden people are cheering on the censors, in fact, wanting them to censor more. If you had to identify in a rather competitive landscape the three worst things that the Biden people have done, what would you say they are and why?
Well, first of all, number one is Biden. Now, let's start with this. I don't care what anybody says. A friend of mine asked me a very simple question. Would you let Joe Biden drive you home from the airport? Now, I know people don't want to discuss this, but how we can mistake the fact that we have somebody who was basically hobbled by senescence. This guy is wizened. He, no matter how you look at it, no matter what, this is a man who barely made sense before. And as you know, Dinesh, not being a physician ourselves, these types of problems do not improve over time. Second of all, the employment of not the thought police, but the thought vigilantes. You know, social media act as either the accelerant or the enzyme or something, which basically shuts down our speech. And what's worse, are the citizens who are empowered and deputized in a kind of a weird free speech, anti-free speech militia who look for what you have said ever in your history. This isn't the government. This is just us. And the third aspect is basically all of the above. Every single day, there is a new rollout of something which you are actually asking yourself, up to and including very quickly, the inclusion of the word racism into everything from postnasal drip to climate change to halitosis, racism, white supremacy. It's just an obfuscation of the obvious. So I could go on, but won't.
Lionel, let's turn to the issue of how conservatives and Republicans should respond to this. I've been sort of a member of institutional conservatism for most of my career, the Reagan administration, the AEI, the Hoover Institution, the kind of classic think tanks. It seems like we've seen a real shift in which those guys are no longer, well, they're certainly no longer on the front lines. I don't really know if they're on any lines at all. Talk about the ways in which conservatives, I mean, is it a failure of comprehension as to where we are, or is it a failure of nerve? What do you think is the most important thing that needs to be done by our side right now?
Well, I started in the world of professional talk radio. This is my 34th year of actual professional commentary. And I started when Rush Limbaugh came about. When conservatism, I understood, and it was Reagan, whether it was paleoconservative versus this neoconservative. And I don't want to get into all these nuances, but it made sense to me. I ask you this, Dinesh, if I could, let's say, bring back Ronald Reagan or William F. Buckley or anybody who was a prototypical classic conservative, the way that you and I speak of, limited government, the Constitution, et cetera, and they would look at this, the first thing they would ask is, where are the conservatives? Where is the GOP? Where is the consensus? What do you stand for? And in as much as Donald Trump, for good, for worse, he was the most transformational president of my lifetime. I know that may sound a lot, but it's true. He did more to galvanize what I thought conservatism was about. The flag, governance, family, basically with the Constitution as the template. But now through people like Liz Cheney, who I guess is a kind of the old neocon last gasp, a Hail Mary into something, people are forgetting what it is that brought them to the dance. And I respectfully submit that this left-right paradigm is an illusion. Two sides of the same coin, Diet Coke, Diet Pepsi. Ultimately, you've got politics over here. And this new form of, I don't want to call it a post-Trumpian anything, but you have a new galvanized groups of people who very quickly are going to be bringing more people in the tent than you could imagine. Because when you have Asian Americans meeting with the Boogaloo boys, and you have gays who have been left out of the discussion, and you have basically African Americans who are going to be completely supplanted by this new undocumented alien or undocumented Democrat, you're seeing new people who are joining forces who before this had nothing in common. So you're going to be seeing a new name, whether it's conservatism or Americanism or constitutionalism, I don't know.
Well, that's a very interesting comment, what you seem to be saying. I mean, I noticed under Reagan years ago that he was expanding the party by bringing in Catholics and Jews. In the White House, I would see, you know, Afghans, I would see nuns. This was not the old Republican Party. What you're saying is that, in a sense, if Reagan were alive today, he'd be a Trumpster. Why? Because he sees that Trump is expanding the party even further. And that's the very opposite of what the Liz Cheney people are saying. They seem to be treating Trump as some kind of betrayal of the Reagan-Bush era. But I think what you're saying is it's actually the very opposite. Hey, Lionel, this was great. Thanks for coming on the podcast. A very interesting observations. I appreciate it.
Thank you, sir. My pleasure.
Does it make sense that the same company that controls half of online retail also passively eavesdrops on your private conversations at home? What about the idea that a single company controls 90% of internet searches, runs your email service, and gets to track everything you do on your smartphone? Big tech is more powerful than most countries are, and they profit by exploiting your personal data. It's time to put a layer of protection between your online activity and these tech juggernauts, and that's why I use ExpressVPN. VPN. Think of how much of your life is on the internet. Sadly, every site you visit, video you watch, or message you send gets tracked and data mined. But when you run ExpressVPN on your device, the software hides your IP address, something big tech can use to personally identify you. So ExpressVPN makes your activity harder to trace and sell to advertisers. ExpressVPN also encrypts 100% of your internet data to keep you safe from hackers and eavesdroppers on your network. And ExpressVPN does all of this without slowing your connection. That's why it's rated the number one VPN service by CNET and Wired. What I like most about ExpressVPN is how easy it is to use. Download the app on your phone or computer, tap one button, and you're protected. Stop handing over your personal data to the big tech monopoly that mines your activity and sells your information. Protect yourself with the VPN I trust to keep me safe online. Visit expressvpn.com/Dinesh. That's expressvpn.com/Dinesh to get 3 extra months free. Go to expressvpn.com/Dinesh. I've talked in a couple of episodes about the philosopher George Berkeley and his astonishing idea that although we take our senses to give us a kind of clear picture of reality out there, of things as they are in themselves, Berkeley says that we have no knowledge of the things in themselves. We only have our experience of them. We have the experience of them in our minds. And that is the only reality we know. Now, I want to close out my discussion of Berkeley by looking at a couple of kind of ingenious efforts to sort of refute him. Because I want to show how it is so difficult to refute this guy. And this is kind of what makes his idea, what I kind of billed it as at the beginning, one of the most disconcerting, in fact, perhaps the most disconcerting idea of all time. See, before Berkeley, philosophers had always taken it for granted that our senses are kind of like a window. You open a window and there's the external world. Your senses give you a kind of clear picture of reality. And Berkeley says, no, your senses are a little bit more like they're a certain type of a glass. Or there's a certain type of a camera that takes pictures of the world, and you don't have the world in itself. You only have the picture. And so the picture is assumed to be a kind of match to the world out there, but you don't actually know that. Now, the philosopher Karl Popper said, this is nonsense. Popper was kind of a defender of science and the scientific method. And Popper goes, this notion that things exist in our mind, and only in our mind, that let's say the sun and stars and trees are only in our mind. Popper goes, I know how to prove this to be wrong. Okay, let's do this. Let's all leave the room and leave a camera facing, let's say, the sun or the stars or the trees. And while we're gone, the camera will take a photo. And then we come back and we look at the photo and we go, aha, clearly the sun and the stars and the trees are really there. They don't just exist in our mind because here's the photo. Berkeley has been refuted. And I just want to point out why this refutation doesn't really work. Because Berkeley's point is that all our experience is in our mind. That applies to the sun. It applies to the stars. It applies to the trees. It also applies to the photo. Because you think that the photo is some kind of independent, free-existing, outside thing that confirms the other outside things. And what Berkeley is saying is, no, all these things, all experience occurs in the mind. Now, the Harvard biologist and cognitive scientist Steven Pinker, more recently, this is from his book called How the Mind Works, he tries his own ingenious effort to refute Berkeley. He says, for example, that if you have two chairs in a room, he says, according to Berkeley, those two chairs exist only in your mind. So, says Pinker, he says, here's what we do. We basically all leave the room and two people come in and they switch the two chairs. They're identical chairs. So everybody now knows that those chairs are not the same. They've in fact been switched. And so, says Pinker, it can't be that the chairs only exist. Our mind may think, well, they're the same chairs, but we know that in reality, the chairs have been swapped. And Pinker goes, there you go. I've refuted Berkeley. Clearly, the chairs don't just exist in our mind. We know that the chairs are now different, even though our mental picture of them is exactly the same. But again, this doesn't really work. It doesn't really work. Why? because it misses the point of what Berkeley is getting at. Again, all experience, says Berkeley, is in the mind. And what does that mean? That means that the original chairs are in the mind. The people who came in to switch them, that's in your mind. Once the chairs are switched, so-called, and again, Berkeley denies the existence of independent chairs. Berkeley's point is it's all in the mind. So you see here how a man like Pinker, sophisticated though he is in general, can't even understand. This is a little bit why it's a little difficult to get a hold of Berkeley, is even intelligent people can't get their heads around what he's saying. And what he's saying is very simple. There's experience and there's, quote, reality. We assume that our experience is a match of reality, but we don't have reality. We only have the experience. Now, I'll conclude with this. We sort of think that this guy Berkeley is so whacked, in Debbie's words, he's so much on drugs, that he's sort of denying experience. We think that when, if, for example, Berkeley, you say, what, Berkeley, are you denying the existence of the Empire State Building? And Berkeley goes, no, I'm not. He goes, ask any ordinary person what the Empire State Building is. And the ordinary person will be like, see, I just saw it. Hey, I just touched it. I can feel it. Hey, I can smell it. I can smell the dust on it. And Berkeley goes, you're right. Your experience is the Empire State Building. There's no other Empire State Building separate from your experience. What you saw, what you felt, what you touched, that is the Empire State Building. That's what I, Berkeley, have been trying to tell you. All we have is experience, and to posit that there is some Empire State Building that exists apart from our sensory perception of it, Berkeley goes, that's something that you cannot provide one shred of evidence for. Show me one thing that you know about that exists outside of your, one external thing that exists outside your sensory perception of it. Show it to me. In fact, it doesn't exist. And so I conclude my discussion of Berkeley just by saying that these are provocative ideas that I think help us to get to the depth of what philosophy does. It tries to probe very hard to what truth is by answering the simple question, how do we know what we know? Debbie and I have gotten to know Dr. Douglas Howard, who founded the company Balance of Nature. This is a remarkable guy. He convinced us we're not eating enough fruits and veggies, even though we thought we were. You don't need to eat the stuff you don't like. Turn to Balance of Nature instead. Can you imagine how you'd feel if you were eating 10 servings of fruits and veggies every single day? Debbie started first, and now I'm doing it. We take 6 daily capsules, and we're set. We get all vital nutrients sourced from 31 fruits and veggies every day. Debbie also swears by the fiber and spice powder. She says she's never been more regular. Join us and experience the Balance of Nature difference for yourself. For a limited time, all new preferred customers get an additional 35% discount and free shipping on your first Balance of Nature order. Use discount code America. Call 800-246-8751 or go to balanceofnature.com and use discount code America. Are there good reasons to believe in God, in immortality, in Christianity? Now, over the years, when I would do debates with leading atheists, they would imply that the answer to this question hinges upon proof. Can you prove that God exists? And my point is, can you prove he doesn't? Because it seems to me that this is a question which cannot be settled on the basis of reason alone. It cannot be settled through definitive proof on either side. This is actually why the believer calls himself, I call myself a believer and not a knower. Why? Because belief does require an ingredient of faith. But then the question becomes, why have faith? Why believe in something of which you are not completely sure? Now, interestingly, the great psychologist William James, by the way, the brother of the novelist Henry James, and himself one of the founders of modern psychology, William James was a pragmatist, and he brought a very interesting sort of pragmatic approach to this question. And he said, look, whenever we think about a particular question about which we can't be totally sure, he said, we have to sort of look at the risk on both sides of the question. So on the one side, for example, if you believe something and it turns out to be false, then you are guilty of a certain kind of metaphysical error, And that is a kind of risk. It's a risk of being part of a certain type of ignorance. But, says James, there are also risks on the other side. The risk of denying immortality is that you could be missing out on some of the benefits of immortality, which you're not sure exist or don't exist. So you have to engage in a certain kind of sensible weighing on the two sides. And James says that that there are a number of pragmatic, or you could say practical, benefits that accrue to the believer. And I want to enumerate a few of what those are. Well, first, Christianity. I'll speak about Christianity, but one could speak more broadly about theism. Christianity provides a solution to the kind of cosmic loneliness that we all feel in the world. I mean, think about it. You come into the world alone. You exit the world alone. At some level, you remain separate from the rest of the world. You have an inner life that is your own. And so there's a sense of deep cosmic loneliness. A belief in God, a belief in immortality, is a remedy for that. Second, Christianity gives you an enduring experience of the sublime. And by that I mean the sublime is that feeling you have, for example, when you look at a terrible rainstorm. Now, it's a feeling of awe, of being part of something greater than you. And Christianity gives you that constantly, because in normal secular experience, the experience of the sublime is extremely rare. It might occur once a year, or maybe sometimes only a few times in a lifetime. But in Christianity, you have the feeling that you're part of something greater because you believe you are. So this sense of being part of something greater gives you a sense of joy, of meaningfulness that you wouldn't otherwise have. Then there's the matter of your own depth. Christianity gives you a way of coping with it. It gives you a sense of hope at the point of death. It gives you a sense that you will be reunited, perhaps, with others who have gone before you. All of us fear death. I mean, that's part of being evolved creatures in the world. We try to survive, which means we try to postpone to avoid death, and death brings with it a certain kind of fear. Now, here is James's point. I think it's a very profound one. Everybody is going to die in any case. That's the point. By not fearing, by taking a certain attitude toward death, that doesn't change the fact that you are going to die. And so James says, I'm now quoting him, that for the believer, the belief in immortality, quote, makes easy and felicitous what is in any case necessary. Now, belief in God, belief in Christianity also gives you a reason to be moral and to pass that morality on to your children. Why? Because Christianity introduces this idea of cosmic justice, of the fact that God is, in a sense, the author of morality. God is the author of that little voice inside of you that says, don't do that. Your conscience is a sort of little spark of divinity in you. And finally, says James, belief in God makes your life better in all kinds of ways. First of all, religious people are, in general, healthier than non-believers. By the way, there's a whole body of evidence on this. If you want a summary of it, look at Harold Koenig's book, Medicine, Religion, and Health. Psychologist Jonathan Haidt points out that religious people are in general happier than non-religious people. And sociologist Arthur Brooks says that religious people are far more generous than non-religious people. So on all these different counts, having not just physical but emotional health, being happier with your life, being better to the people around you. You see here, and I think James would say, these are the things that count the most. At the end of the day, it's not about having some abstract belief in what can be discerned from the rotation of the planets. It's ultimately about the actual practical benefits that religious belief brings to the believer, benefits that are denied, in fact, refused by the non-believer. I call it the Mike Lindell Super Combo, the pillows and the sheets. Mike Lindell has come out with the world's most comfortable bed sheets. He found some of the best cotton in the world in a region where the Sahara Desert, the Nile River, and the Mediterranean Sea all come together to create the perfect weather conditions for growing cotton. His new Giza Dream bed sheets are made with this long staple cotton. Mike guarantees, and I guarantee, they'll be the most comfortable sheets you ever own. The first night you sleep on them, you'll never want to sleep on anything else. The Giza Dream sheets are available in a variety variety of colors, like all of Mike's products. They come with a 60-day money-back guarantee and a 10-year warranty. Right now, buy one, get one free by calling 800-876-0227 and use promo code Dinesh. For a limited time, buy one, get one free. Call 800-876-0227 or go to MyPillow.com. Make sure to use promo code Dinesh. It's time for our mailbox. Hey, if you want to send a question, audio or video, please do so by emailing it to questiondinesh@gmail.com. Here is today's question. Listen.
Hi, Dinesh. I'm an American citizen, but I am originally from Brazil. The situation with our immigration right now causes Brazilian people to criticize my position in the fact that I think that immigration process should be difficult. We should really want to live here and honor our legal passage, our legal process, and that's how I feel about it. I don't think that it's free for all. I don't think an unorganized process will help anybody, not immigrants or the country. So how do I argument to friends who believe that I'm trying to hold America all for myself and all the good things that America has to offer?
Yeah, that's very, I think, a very thoughtful question. The assumption on the part of some people on the left is that there is some kind of a right to immigrate, that immigration, basically crossing into the border into someone else's country and becoming a member of that country, is a right. But I think this is a confused understanding of what a right is. Rights aren't just things that you sort of think are cool. Rights don't just derive from wants. I want something, therefore I have a right to it. This is kind of the, I would call it the four-year-old sensibility. I want a cookie, therefore I have a right to a cookie. No, you don't. Now, the point is countries are formed by social compacts, by an agreement among the citizens that live there. I mean, think about something like even the welfare state. The benefits are based upon the idea that you pay into a system and then you derive the benefits of that system. Now, the people in a country have every right to decide who should come in, who should be a new member, and they should can set the standards for that. And by and large, you can use two different sets of criteria, which to me are both valid. One, what is the immigrant bringing to the economic value of the country? How is the immigrant going to add, benefit our country, and make it better for the people who are already here? Two, does the immigrant want to be part of our club? Does the immigrant want to assimilate to our way of life? Does the immigrant want to become one of us? Why else join our club? Go join somebody else's club. Well, go join a club that doesn't care who its members are. And so when you ask the question and say, hey, I think the immigration process should be difficult, I think what you mean by difficult is that there should be reasonable criteria. And there's nothing wrong with this. There's nothing bigoted about it. You're not establishing a racial criteria. You're saying immigrants, whatever color they are, wherever they come from, have to meet certain standards of this country. Why? Because we think it's a good country. We think it's a great country. We want people who are going to contribute rather than simply come here to be a drain on the people who are already here.
Subscribe to the Dinesh D'Souza podcast on Apple, Google, and Spotify, or watch on Rumble, YouTube, and SalemNow.com.